Well, hey there, Jonathan Doyle with you, and it's great to have just a few moments of your time to go back through some of the key points from this recent presentation I did with you with the Melbourne Rebels on a few key points that had seemed to be really relevant for where you're at the moment, and I just wanted to work back through those. I actually did a great recording on the day, which was fantastic, all except for the recording part, which didn't actually work. So if you're listening to this and you weren't there, I want you to imagine a brilliant presentation with lots of energy and enthusiasm. Imagine that in your mind's eye, because this is a recording of what I did live. So we're going to change a few bits around, but if you were in the room, you're definitely going to remember a few of these key points. So over the years, I have found that podcasts and audio have had a huge influence. It's not just about learning styles. Like, some people are definitely, you know, audio-based learners, so often you find listening to this stuff can be really helpful. But I've formed a discipline over the years of just trying to use, travel time, and you guys get so much of that, obviously, with your schedules as athletes. But, you know, when I'm driving somewhere, when I'm on the bike, I really take a chance to listen to some of the best people in the world. I mean, it's one of the great things about the internet is that it's leveled the playing field. I often say that, you know, at other times in history, if you wanted to access great information, you know, it was really hard. Unless you were from the aristocracy, you didn't get to study at all. You definitely didn't get to go to college or TAFE or university. So it was only the elite in society that got to be around good ideas. You know, one of the great things about the internet and podcasts and audio is that you can get the best ideas in the world often for free. Now, I'm not saying that I have all the best ideas in the world, but there's definitely a few ideas here that are useful. And repetition is also important. So just listening to this podcast two or three times, it'll be really useful. You know, I said to you on the day that one of my favorite sayings is that you don't need a whole bunch of great ideas to change your life. You know, often people are looking for this, you know, meta narrative, this big story that's going to change everything in their lives. But the rest of that quote is that, you know, you don't need a whole bunch of great ideas to change your life, just one good idea that you're actually prepared to use. You know, so it doesn't matter what you know, what matters is what you do with what you know. And I've been really challenged on this myself lately. You know, I accumulate a lot of knowledge and I read so much and I'm always looking for the edge in different areas. But I finally realized it doesn't matter how much I learn or read, what matters is what I do with what I learn or read. So as you go through this, I want you to be awake to one or two key points that would be really useful to you. And then make an effort to put those into practice in practical ways. And I'll talk about that as we go. So I want to take you to the two key things that I discussed on the day. I want to remind you of those. And the reason I was there essentially first was to come from outside your community into your space and put some names and some shapes on things that you're probably all feeling. And that's the experience of disappointment. You know, from what I understood, it had been a very positive preseason. You've had some big cultural change there over recent years. And you went into the season very positive. You know, there's a lot of energy there. And with a few, you know, close losses here and there, the momentum shifts a little bit. And it is incredibly normal to feel the human experience of disappointment. And I said on the day that if you don't experience disappointment in that organization, so in your organization there, if you don't feel some sense of disappointment about the outcomes of this year, then we got a huge problem. Because if you don't feel disappointment, it obviously means you weren't connected to the outcomes. I mean, if you don't care about the outcomes, you're not going to feel disappointment because you're like, you know, this is a job. I got my mind elsewhere. I just want to get through this. And then my agent's going to do this. So I'm going to find a job here. And then you're not committed. So, and I said to you really clearly that if you don't feel disappointment, you're probably in the wrong place. And life is very short. You know, with no disrespect to my Buddhist brothers and sisters, we're probably getting one shot at this. You're not coming back. So why not be somewhere you really want to be? I'm big on that. You know, really put yourself in the places that you want to be, because you can't bring your best energy to places you don't want to be. So the experience of disappointment is actually a really positive one. I know that sounds crazy to hear. And you're like, well, how could disappointment be positive? You know, we want outcomes, we want to achieve, we want to win, and then now we're disappointed. How's that a positive thing? Well, we're going to get to that. We're going to talk about the benefits of disappointment and how we can leverage it. And I also made another important distinction, which is to understand the difference between regret and disappointment. Regret means that you are sort of really responsible for a negative outcome. So, you know, I think the example I used was, imagine you're an alcoholic and you know you destroy your family and all this stuff happens, and 20 years later you look back and you feel a great sense of regret. Why? Because you know you had chances to change, there were offers of help, but you weren't able to, and you chose behaviors, you did things that really damaged people and damaged you and damaged key relationships. Now, regret there would be really important, and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous teaches that kind of principle. It helps us to, you know, identify where, or this whole 12 steps methodology helps us to identify, you know, relationships that we've wounded and how to fix them. So regret is what happens when you've done something that's really caused a negative outcome. Now, I said to you guys that it's unlikely that you experience regret because you can't be solely responsible for the outcome of a season. You know, even if somebody, you know, had the grand final goal kick, and we all know that happened recently, and they missed, they might feel regret. They might feel, well, have I done it differently? But I just feel, as for you guys as professional athletes, most of the time in the pressure cooker of, you know, competition, you're not going to be feeling huge amounts of regret because, you know, it's happening so fast. You're responding to circumstances as they happen. And, you know, you do all your skills acquisition work. You bring that to game day. So regret, this feeling of I did something terrible and I wish I could have changed it, probably doesn't really describe the emotion I'm talking about. I'm talking about this broader experience of disappointment, of we wanted something to happen, it didn't happen, and how do we actually go about changing it? So that was kind of the elephant in the room. And if you remember, I gave you a very practical tip here, and that was around the concept of journaling. Now, I am a real evangelist on this concept of journaling. Like, I have been doing this for years. And on the day, you remember, I showed you my journal, and you could see just, you know, how much is in there and how much writing I do. I shared with you a great quote from Thomas Aquinas, who said that, you know, the hand, and this is in the 13th century, the hand is the conjoined instrument of the mind. The hand is the conjoined instrument of the mind. There is something unique about writing. There's something special about pen and paper and how it allows us to open up and unleash what's really happening, often in our semi-conscious, our subconscious. So what I said to you is that this idea of disappointment, don't waste that. I really encourage you to find some time just to go to a cafe, go somewhere quiet, get yourself in a good, relaxed state, you know, have something to eat, be in a positive place, and then very privately begin to journal your experience of disappointment. You know, journal about the season, experiences when something you wanted something to happen, it didn't. And what you find is that as you journal, things open up, ideas open up, things that you wouldn't have thought. And I shared with you that I recently in Noosa, I was up there with a family on a holiday. I got up very early. I journaled for about 2 hours, and I got this incredible insight into something that had been bothering me for about 20 years. So don't waste that, you know. And I said to you, you know, if you think you're the kind of person, well, I don't do journaling, you know, it's not my thing. I don't do much writing. I'm not that kind of person. What I threw back at you was that as professionals, whether you're in, you know, in the office or whether you're on the field, you've had to learn new skills. Being professional is always about learning new skills. I mean, as an athlete, you don't sort of go to a coach, I don't want to learn that skill. It's too hard. I don't want to do that one. You're always up for learning new skills. And I really want to give you journaling as a crucial one. So think about that. Underneath the podcast here, go back to the website and I'll have a link to an entire podcast I did just on journaling. So I want you to listen to that and make this a part of your discipline. It's a very powerful life discipline that I use all the time. So the next thing I want to do is talk about three cultural mistakes around the topic of blame and disappointment and how we deal with that. Now, there are three things that culturally people do when they feel disappointed, and they're big mistakes. And I want to point them out quickly. And the first one, which I just alluded to, was blame. You know, we are such a blame-centric culture. The minute something doesn't happen, it doesn't go the way we want, whether it's in politics, business, life, you pick an area, people shift to blame rapidly. And I want to suggest to you that blame is the mindset of underperforming people. Blame is the mindset of underperforming people. I just flew back from Perth on Friday night. I was over there speaking at a leadership conference, and I found a great book, which was, you know, tapping into the Stoic philosophers and, you know, the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius and his theories around, you know, just acceptance and looking for the, you know, the message in the obstacle. You know, not shifting instantly to blame. And I do a whole separate series of seminars, and in my book, which I hope you have, I talk about obstacles and not shifting to blame. So looking at your season, it would be very easy, either publicly or in your own heart and mind, to look for people who you could attach, you know, blame and failure to. It's now, I'm not talking about when somebody is incompetent and they're genuinely incompetent and they're genuinely causing a problem. Well, then if that's the case, then the best thing we can do is move them on. Because if they're incompetent, they can either learn a skill set, we can either help them learn a skill set, or we can position them to be somewhere else where they're going to be more happy. So that's different. Incompetence is one thing where you can identify it, and you're probably going to be doing some kind of end of season review anyway. But that's not really what I'm getting at. I'm getting at just this knee-jerk reaction to it's someone else's fault. So the first thing with disappointment is we look at and we go, you know what, I'm not going to blame everybody else. Yes, we're going to do a review, but I'm going to put my hand up and say, where did I contribute here? You know, where did I not bring my A game? Where did I not bring 100%? Where am I responsible? But you know, behind all of that is a bigger question. It's the bigger question is, what can I learn? You know, behind all of this is a sense of, what is this teaching me? Rather than blame somebody, it's like, where is the message here? So the next key one was what I call drawing the wrong conclusion by framing the wrong questions. This is the next cultural mistake, is that when something goes wrong, we experience disappointment, we don't ask the right questions. So when we fail, it's like dumb questions. Like, you know, if you ask your brain, I really, you'll remember me saying this, I said, if you ask your brain a dumb question, it's going to give you a dumb answer. If you say, why did we fail? Then it'll give you dumb answers like because you weren't good enough or because you did this or because we were lazy or we were just not capable. But if you start to ask your brain great questions, it'll start to give you much better answers. You know, great questions like, what can we learn from this? What is the situation teaching us? What is the positive here that we can't see at the moment? You could endlessly frame questions. What would two outsiders say about our experience? You can just frame questions on and on. And people go, well, this is just mind tricks, man. This is like just, you know, making up, you know, little mind tricks to change things. I go, absolutely. One of the biggest revelations I've had in the last couple of years is that, you know, for years I'd read about positive thinking and cognitive behavior therapy and different things you could do. And I thought, man, whatever. You know, I don't think you can just trick yourself into behavior change. Then I discovered you actually can. It's amazing. If you feed your brain the right stuff, it'll come to the party. But I've got to say, most people are just not feeding their brain with the right stuff at all. So, you know, ask better questions. When you're journaling, write down, you know, Brian Tracy used to be big on this, you know, write down 10 better questions. And you go, I can't think of 10. You'd be surprised. They could be crazy. They could just seem weird. You don't have to share them with anybody. But when disappointment comes or the experience of failure comes, then you've got to write good questions, ask your brain better questions. Now, the third cultural mistake. So we've done two or three. Number one was jumping into blame. Number two was framing the wrong questions. Number three, this is a real favorite, assuming that success was preceded by some form of personal or group brilliance or genetics. We rarely hear or see of any link between failure preceding success or being an efficient cause of it. So, a couple of clarifications there. This idea that I really brought this up a few times, efficient cause. This goes back to Aristotle, who listed four key causes. But an efficient cause is something in the environment that creates an outcome. And the example I gave was, if you think of a flower growing, an efficient cause of its growth are things like rain, sunlight, soil, you know, soil quality. They are efficient causes. They're things outside that contribute to the result. So here's the cultural mistake. We have been raised to kind of see success or successful people as fundamentally different. We look at successful people in the world. You can name them, your Steve Jobs, your Bill Gates, and we go, you know, these people are just born successful. They came from money, or they had opportunity, or they met the right people. The stars aligned and success came. Or we look at very successful teams and we go, well, they've just got the best genetics. Well, sure, genetics play a big part. I mean, you don't play American football, you know, weighing kind of 75 kilos, right? Unless you are unbelievably talented. Genetics matter. But what it's the wrong filter. We're sort of filtering our reality through an incorrect filter. We make this assumption, and assumptions are incredibly powerful. If our assumptions are wrong, they can have a huge impact. So the assumption that, wow, everybody who is successful just was always successful is like a cultural fairy tale that I really want to kind of work on at the moment. Now, What I did on the day was take you through some real inversions, some paradigm shifts around people who we would see as incredibly successful, who actually come from experiences of enormous failure, disappointment, and regret. So the first one that I gave you on the day, and I'm going to give you some quotes here that I shared, was Abraham Lincoln. You know, obviously seen as one of the greatest leaders in history. And I read the 4,000-page, two-volume John Burlingame biography. And what you encounter is somebody who suffered and failed enormously. Now, I'll spin through these, but basically, listen to these carefully. 1832, he lost his job, and he was defeated in his first attempt to stand for the state legislature. 1 year later, 1833, he was bankrupted completely. 1835, 2 years later, his fiancée died. And that's a really poignant moment in the biography because he was deeply in love with her, cared about her immensely, and was absolutely devastated. You know, he wandered through these forests on his own, barely ate. His friends were actually at the point of almost, you know, sort of intervention, right? They were going to grab him and have him locked up for his own safety. They were that worried about him. His grief was so profound. 1836, 1 year later, he had a complete nervous breakdown. Complete nervous breakdown. 1838, 2 years later, failed in his bid to become the Speaker of the House. 1843, he failed in his first nomination for the US Congress. 1848, he failed, well, he got in a few years later, but then 5 years later, he wanted to be renominated, and he failed to even be renominated. 1854, he failed in his bid for the US Senate. And a couple more I wanted to take you through. So this is just, you know, look at this tradition, this kind of history of failure, pain, loss, and grief in his life. 1856, he failed in his nomination to become the US Vice President. 1858, he failed again to be nominated, to be elected to the US Senate. And then finally, in 1860, at the start of the Civil War, he's elected President. So just look at this experience of, you know, incredible failure and loss. You know, we look at him and all we see often is the end point. You know, you see the Gettysburg Address or the Emancipation Proclamation, and we never see all this stuff that preceded it. So my pitch to you on the day and now as you listen is it just possible that people who experience disappointment and failure can go on to extraordinary success, but not only that, is it possible that their sense of failure or their sense of loss contributes to their success? I mean, look at Lincoln, right? I mean, for Lincoln, I think probably what happened was he grew up incredibly poor. His father was violent, the hillbilly, he was brutalized. His mother died when he was 12. I wonder if all these things just generated a kind of deep perseverance. You know, he could stand in the midst, like when it came to the Civil War, he could stand in the midst of carnage and chaos and loss and grief while everybody else was losing their, you know, losing it completely. He's able to stay there. Why? Because he's been through so much. So my opening inversion here, I'm big on paradigm shifts and inversions, is to flip this around and go, what if failure was a crucial ingredient to success? The next one I shared was the British defeat, the failure at Dunkirk. I mean, this was the start of the Second World War. The US had not entered the war. The Russians hadn't entered the war. You know, 338,226 British soldiers evacuated off the beach in France in Dunkirk. You know, they lost, and I listed that basically what they left behind, if you remember the list, was enough equipment for 10 divisions. Now, that's around about 30,000 to 40,000 soldiers in a division. So vast supplies of ammunition, 880 field guns, 310 large caliber cannons, 500 anti-aircraft guns, 850 anti-tank guns, 11,000 machine guns, 700 tanks, and 20,000 motorcycles, and 45,000 trucks. That was what was left behind. I mean, that is a massive failure at the start of the war. And, you know, the distance at the narrowest point of the channel, you know, the English Channel, is only 33.2 kilometres across. So now the entire German Army Group B is camped just, you know, 30 to 40 kilometres from your coastline, and you've just lost this vast amount of material. I mean, we can't say that's not a failure, but my question on the day was, what was the result of the failure? And the result of the failure was that 3 days after that, the Neville Chamberlain stepped down and Winston Churchill became Prime Minister. And listen to this, you know, incredible words, the first words of Winston Churchill after the defeat of Dunkirk. He said, "I would say to the House, as I have said to those who have joined this government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival." So, two things here. First is that the experience of failure, disappointment, and loss leads to a kind of galvanizing, leads to a kind of sudden awakening of the British people and the British spirit under the leader who kind of really embodies it. So can you see here how failure and loss became a catalyst to just the behaviors and belief systems that were necessary for incredible later success? And again, I shared with you that, again, you look at Churchill and you go, well, he's one of the greatest leaders ever, and Churchill was just the right person at the right time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And yes, Churchill came from an enormously privileged background. One of his relatives was the Earl of Marlborough. He grew up at Blenheim Palace. He came from incredible, history and prestige and privilege. And, you know, but what you don't know is that he was the architect. He was the guy that designed the Dardanelles campaign, the Gallipoli campaign. He was very successful very early in his life. But after the loss at Gallipoli, he experienced massive, massive, failure. And he was demoted and he was in the wilderness for like 30 to 40 years. You know, he went from being Lord of the Admiralty, and in the biography, one of the biographies on his life, it says he went from being Lord of the Admiralty, from living on Admiralty House, you know, a place where Lord Nelson had been Lord of the Admiralty, to basically working out of a broom cupboard in a little office in Whitehall, which is the political precinct in London. So here's another person who starts strong and then experiences enormous failure, disappointment, and loss. But then all of that experience prepares him for the moment when success is really, really crucial. The last one I shared with you was really quite moving, was J.K. Rowling, J.K. Rowling sold something like, 400 million copies of a book. She's the most published, widely published author in world history, and she has a personal fortune of over $1 billion. So when I was researching my time coming down to work with you, it was like, really getting my head around, some of these people and joining this links in my head between failure and later success. But her life, and I'm going to put the video in under the podcast here. So if you're listening to the podcast, come back and you can see some of the YouTube video of her speech, because she was asked to do a commencement address at Harvard. And listen to some of these key words. These are her words right now. She says, "By any conventional measure, a mere 7 years after my graduation day, I had failed on an epic scale. An exceptionally short-lived marriage had imploded and I was jobless. A lone parent and as poor as it is possible to be in modern Britain. The fears that my parents had had for me and that I had had for myself had both come to pass. And by every usual standard, I was the biggest failure I knew. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that failure is fun. That period of my life was a dark one, and I had no idea then how far the tunnel extended. So why do I talk about the benefits of failure? Simply because failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was, and I began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. I was set free because my greatest fear had been realized, and I was still alive, and I had a daughter whom I adored, and I had an old typewriter and a big idea. And so, rock bottom was the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life." Now listen to this last line from J.K. Rowling. She says this, "Failure taught me things about myself that I could have learned no other way." Seriously, this is absolute gold. I love that story. I mean, here is somebody who we look at And most of us only see the end result, you know, the book sales, the creativity, the global success, the personal fortune. What we don't see is everything that kind of went before it. You know, this incredible loss, failure, embarrassment, rejection, pain becomes a catalyst. I mean, can you picture her looking at her daughter, you know, almost sleeping out of a car, living on, you know, pension and welfare checks, but this idea is still there. And all of that sort of failure galvanizes into this incredible sense of purpose. So, you know, watch her video and think about some of these examples. Every time in your life, if you remember nothing else I say, remember that when you fail, if you're intelligent and you ask great questions and you think, you might just find that in the seeds of your failures, in the seeds of your disappointment, is the harvest of future success. I can promise you this in my own life. I have failed so many times, and hopefully I'll remember to do this, and you may have seen it, but I'm going to put the little video, another YouTube video there from Michael Jordan, you know, the great failure video where he talks about, you know, missing over 900 shots, you know, 30-odd times he was given the ball to sink the game-winning shot, and he missed. And he just says at the end of this commercial, he goes, you know, I fail and I fail and I fail, and that's why I succeed. So the last thing I wanted to do, I'm going to do just a shortened version of the second part that I did with you, which I framed as what I call the greatest of enemies. And this is basically a crucial ingredient for elite athletes and for, look, I think for all of us in life in general. And it's the problem of what we call narcissism. Very simply, I think our culture is becoming increasingly, rapidly self-obsessed. The Professor Jean Twenge from University of San Diego, PhD, is writing some great stuff on this. And her research is showing that narcissism scores are really almost double what they were a generation ago. And they're not changing. If you're not familiar, narcissism comes from Greek mythology, from the youth Narcissus, who fell in love with his own reflection. So he came across a pool of very still water, saw his own reflection and fell totally in love and became so totally self-obsessed that he died. He starved to death by staring at his own reflection because it was so beautiful. So from narcissists, we get narcissism, which is this endless focus on ourselves. Now, I don't think anything can poison or kill an elite sporting organization or any business or corporate or basically any family than this huge growing problem of narcissism. I also shared with you some research from a great new book by Anne Mann, and it's called The Life of I, The New Culture of Narcissism. I just bought that book, and it's a really good read. There's a great chapter on Lance Armstrong. So from an elite sports perspective, you can see what happens when somebody has a whole bunch of factors that feed into this self-worship. But here's a quote from Anne Mann. She says, "There is very good evidence that the problem of narcissism is growing worse. Changes in our culture have created an economic, social, and relational world that not only supports, but celebrates narcissism." So, long story short, this is going to get a lot worse. Social media, reality TV, you know, social media and internet are kind of creating these worlds where we present the absolute best of ourselves. Look, I get that, you know, I understand it's what we want to do, but it's having some pretty big social consequences. So my pitch to you as elite athletes or staff working or whoever is listening to this, I don't know where this is going to end up, and if you weren't there on the day, I still believe this will be very useful to hear. Narcissism's a killer. It kills leadership, it kills service, it kills the experience of care and common vision in any organization. So let me make this incredibly simple. If you want to be a successful organization, you got to get rid of the narcissists as fast as possible, or basically train everybody in the organization to be reflective and to be very sensitized to narcissism in their own lives. And the examples that I gave you on the day, I'm not going to go through them as such now. I gave you examples of some people that have won the Victoria Cross, some people from concentration camps. They're very moving stories. I also gave you one of a US Marine who recently won the Congressional Medal of Honor. He's in a machine gun nest and this hand grenade's thrown in and he doesn't even think. His mate is next to him and he jumps on top of the grenade. His first impulse was complete self-sacrifice. So the antidote to narcissism is complete self-sacrifice. And I shared with you on the day that these are very big ideas, right? They sound really grand, as if you can just shift your life in 30 seconds. But I gave you a great quote from Aristotle, You know, because in his ethics, he was framing the question of, you know, he was recalling a time when he was asked, how does the courageous person become courageous? And the Greeks were fascinated by that question. How do you see somebody who has got tons of courage or tons of empathy or tons of creativity or tons of anything? How did they end up like that? The Greeks wanted to know, were they born like that? Did the gods give it to them? How did it happen? So how does the courageous person become courageous? So Aristotle stops and he just ponders for a moment. He just looks up and he says, well, they do courageous things. They do courageous things. Aristotle understood that we become what we do. This is a crucial insight, and I've taught this all over the world. We become what we do most often. You know, Robert Frost, the famous metaphysical poet, said, you know, that a man is what he thinks about all day long. What we constantly think about and do, we gradually become. So to beat narcissism, what's necessary is for an organization to have people in it who are just quietly, consistently focused upon the needs of others. So captains of elite sporting teams have to be the exemplars of this. They have to be the guys that really model and embody these principles. There's a great story told about the All Blacks, and I'm very sure this is true. I actually think I read this in a biography. One of the players, he said that in the All Blacks, the three senior players, in each test match, the three most senior players in the team are responsible for cleaning the dressing room, for collecting everything, making sure it's all checked. I mean, do you get that? It's like the higher up the hierarchy you go, the more you're expected to serve and contribute. I could talk about this all day. I have entire seminars about how we do this, but it's very simple. We have to be other-focused. We have to be focused on the needs of other people, how we can share with them, how we can really serve their needs. And in doing that, we become a certain kind of person and our organization begins to shift. I think that the great teams, whether that's corporate or sporting, become organizations where they will virtually, you know, metaphorically at least, die for each other, where your focus is so on the needs of the other person that you jump on a grenade for them, at least, you know, metaphorically speaking. So that is the kind of metaphor I want to leave you with, that narcissism in its many, many forms is going to kill organizations. Now, especially for you guys in an elite sporting environment, the temptations to narcissism are huge. You know, a lot of your lives, you've been good at stuff and you've been looked after well because you are good at stuff, and that's cool, and no problem with that. But the danger is that it develops an entitlement mentality that, you know, I've got to think about my own career, I've got to think about my own needs, I'm only focused on my own outcomes. The problem is that doesn't work with team sports eventually. It doesn't matter if you have a team of immensely talented athletes, if they don't give a damn about each other and if they won't be cohesive, then success is going to be incredibly limited. And even if you have some success, it won't be as enjoyable and as meaningful and as life-changing and as rich as if you really achieve together. And that is built by the tiniest action. So I said on the day that this means when you're making a coffee, you ask other people if they want one. When you're going to do something that's, you know, for yourself, you consider, should I do this for someone else? You know, just this, our language, you know, whether we are affirming of people rather than, you know, in this culture, you know, we're very good at, you know, basically making fun of each other and being very critical, but just our language patterns, our language structures to build up people rather than to tear them down, to be outwardly focused on how can I lift up, elevate, serve, care for the people around me, whether that's in a family, whether that's in a, you know, top corporation, whether that's in an elite sporting environment. This is nothing new under the sun here. This is not some life-changing, massive new book, Seven Steps to Changing the Planet. This is basically how to live well and how to become a good human person and in the process achieve really important outcomes. So I'm going to wrap up now. That is kind of a summary of the key ideas. So the two big ideas are managing failure into disappointment and seeing the seeds of future success in the experiences of disappointment and failure and allowing them to shape you. And secondly, dealing with this greatest of enemies, a growing culture of narcissism. So I hope you can put those into practice. I look forward to getting down there again to work with you soon. But I'd love you to share this with people. I haven't mentioned specifically the name of the organization I'm doing this for, which is cool. But any team has been through these experiences. So if you want to share this with somebody, I'd love that. Grab the link at the top, flip it to someone and say, hey, download this podcast, have a listen. So I'm Jonathan Doyle. I hope it's useful and I'll be speaking to you again really soon.